It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America. If you'll stand with me and fight by my side and cast your ballot for me, I promise you this, we will not just win Missouri, we will win this general election, and together we will change this country and we will change the world. Thank you.
Sandy Rios with you. We had no idea when Barack Obama took the stage to make that prediction, really and truly, how deeply he was going to transform not only the world, but certainly this country. And the effects of it, we're still living. Today, we're going to talk about a particular area which affects each and every one of us, and that is how Barack Obama's policies affected America's military. In some ways, it's an untold story. I've talked about it a lot at this microphone, but not in this way. And our next guest not only served in the military and experienced what those changes meant, saw the effects on our effectiveness, but then he also saw, as he left the military, the devastating effects. He's done a book, written a book called Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. James Assan served as a captain in the U.S. Army. He's a graduate of the University of Virginia Law School. He also graduated from the U.S. Army Ranger School and received the Bronze Star Medal in Afghanistan. You may have seen James with Tucker Carlson, or you might have heard him on National Public Radio. I'm actually wondering, James, how that went. Thanks for joining us. How was that chat with National Public Radio?
First of all, it's great to join you, Sandy. When I talked to NPR, it was actually about toxic masculinity, or you know, the myth thereof. That chat was interesting, and as you can imagine, I took the position that what ails our society is not toxic masculinity, but a lack of authentic masculinity. The book rollout has been great. Gotten some fan mail from the left, of course, but
yes, I'm sure you
but
have.
But overall, it's been positive.
The only reason I ask you about NPR, the last time I was on NPR about something controversial, they actually ended up ending the interview early. I remember
wow.
It was something very, you know, very diametrically opposed to their views on the world. And so they pretty much let me talk for like 5 minutes and then they ended it hastily. It was really funny. Not funny, but that's just the way it is. Hey, James,
yeah.
I hinted at your service, but let's talk about it because you did serve in Afghanistan. So let me ask you something unrelated to your book for a second. You must have very mixed feelings about any negotiations with the Taliban, I'm guessing.
Yeah, very much so. In part because, you know, the Taliban is not a group that can be trusted in any way, shape, or form. I know people have given their lives overseas, and that's because of the Taliban. At the same time, there isn't a whole lot left that we can accomplish in Afghanistan. We've done, and I think in a lot of ways, what we set out to do, which was decimating al-Qaeda, and the Middle East now in 2019 is very different than the Middle East in 2001. So I definitely have some mixed feelings about it, but I think on the whole, the push to disengage from Afghanistan is a good one.
It's interesting. I wanted your perspective, so that's interesting. That was a bonus. Let me just ask you, though, as a young guy, which I'm sure you aren't too old now, so you must have been very young when you went into the service, and you have, granted, I gave your credentials. You graduated in law at the University of Virginia. I'm sure that happened afterwards, but you have some great credentials. You're obviously a very bright guy.
Thank
so
you.
Why did you choose to go into the American military? What was your motivation?
Well, I come from a family with a background of service. So my grandfather was a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, and all the uncles on my mom's side served in either the Army or the Marines. And I also had a very, very good mentor who was a high school teacher of mine who served in Vietnam and actually did three tours over there. And he went to Ranger School. And so I looked at the character traits that people like my grandfather and people like my high school teacher embodied. And I wanted to emulate those and be that kind of person. But most of all, you know, when I signed up, we were a country at war and we're still a country at war. And I just first and foremost wanted to serve. And if I felt that if I didn't go, then somebody else would be in my place. And I'd rather that person.
Let me repeat your words. You write in your book that the military that you entered in as a second lieutenant during the early years of Barack Obama's presidency was nothing like the Army that you left in late
Absolutely.
2015. All right, so let's start this way. How would you describe the Army that you entered in the early years of Obama's administration?
Well, it was focused first and foremost on what the military's purpose should always be, which is simply preparing to defend us all by fighting and winning America's wars. And, you know, it was mission-driven and focused not on sensitivities or political correctness, although, you know, there was already kind of some movement in that direction from the beginning of the Obama years. But by the time that I was leaving, and then even after, because I still have several family members across all the various branches of the military, and most of my friends are still in, it changed remarkably. And those changes were driven from the top down by progressive ideologues in the Obama DOD and the Obama administration who simply viewed the military as a blunt force tool for social change, for driving broader social change, rather than, you know, as I mentioned just a second ago, what it should be, which is simply an institution that is designed to fight and win America's wars.
Let me ask you, when as a soldier, that's different. Now you're looking
sure.
at it from a different perspective, because we're going to get into some of your research and what you did to write this book. But when did you, as a soldier, first start noticing those changes? And in what way? What form did that take?
Well, so I think there were cultural changes that were starting to take place, such as the push towards political correctness. There were endless PowerPoints on various, for lack of a better term, politically correct topics, whether that's, you know, the equal opportunity topics or anything else. But then when there was that push to create gender-neutral infantry units or mixed-sex infantry units versus the military's traditional all-male infantry units, that's kind of when the sea change really took place in terms of policy, at least. And it continued with the transgender policy put in by the Obama administration, which allowed service members to serve according to the physical readiness standards of whichever gender they identified with versus those designed for their biological sex. And those came right after I left, but that was all kind of part of that same push. And I remember talking to some of my soldiers even before we went overseas, and they said, well, you know, they're not going to make these types of changes, right? Like, it's nonsensical. How could that possibly help us accomplish the mission? And at the time, I guess I was a little bit naive, because I told them, no, there's no way. You know, this doesn't help us fight and win wars. This doesn't make you and I safer. This isn't going to happen. But in fact, it did. And we're still paying the price. And I think the American people have been kept in the dark about the true consequences of those policy changes, which is a big reason why I decided to write the book.
Which is that we are not ready for war. And we can have all the hardware we want, all the technology, but we have a weakened personnel. It's, you know, you see this. I remember
That's
watching
exactly right.
Henry V, that with Kenneth Branagh. I don't know if you've ever seen it. But it's a Shakespearean.
Sure.
That's one of my favorite movies. I used to watch that with my son when he was little, honestly. And of course, it is the will and the character and the determination of the soldiers more often than not determines the outcome of the battle, not the hardware. I mean, there's history is rife with stories of great armies being defeated by determined small bands of warriors. Is that pie in the sky, or is that true, what I just said?
No, that's absolutely true. And and to be clear, the men and women who are serving in the military are still just the finest people this country has to offer. But the changes imposed are hampering their abilities. And we talked about this readiness crisis, and that was a conversation during much of the Obama era about, you know, well, we only have so many planes ready, we only have so many ships ready, and that's a big deal. But the cultural changes that were imposed are the lasting readiness crisis, and that will persist long after, you know, we repair everything and rebuild. You know, they impose harm that a simple appropriations bill can't fix.
Yeah.
And the longer those changes stay in place, the more ingrained they become, and the harder they are to reverse, and the more damaging they become, really.
You know, James, from my own memory of covering this issue, the first time this came to my attention, I'm not sure which came first, the chicken or the egg here, but I think I remember
sure.
the training stage standards being lowered. I remember a friend of mine going back in to fly Apache helicopters after we went back to war. He'd already served and was retired and then went back in. And he talked about the training, how you would hold up, when you got tired, you'd hold up a card that said, I forgot what the card said, but the rigorous training was like silly. If you were tired or they were being too hard on you, you held up some sort of a card and they would stop. And then the second thing
there's definitely reduced standards in a lot of cases, and I think what we'll get into in a little bit is how that played out. A scandal I uncovered at Army Ranger School, and in terms of deciding whether or not to create those gender-neutral infantry units. But just for one small example that I can use that's emblematic of these changes that are being pushed, I think most Americans would be shocked and frankly appalled to learn that at the U.S. Naval Academy, there are safe space placards outside instructors' doors, both military and civilian. And it's not all of them, but it's a substantial number.
Now, just to clarify, you said safe space stickers.
Yes,
safe space stickers.
Outside a gender studies professor at Yale, if you didn't see the Naval Academy markings, you would be hard-pressed to distinguish between the two. And they say, among other things, that the instructors have taken a sensitivity course called Trans 101, put on by contractors from Google. And so I include pictures of those signs. I took them myself in the book just because you almost have to see them to believe them. But that's just one small example of kind of what you're getting at in terms of cultural changes.
Yes, and I'm going to just touch on these things, and then we're going to take a break and go and touch on them in depth. But I also remember the Navy. They started allowing women to serve with men on the ships, and then there was an outbreak of pregnancies on the ships because the girls were, in the berths very, I don't know if they were next to them, but they were very close to them. Just a disastrous, ridiculous setup for sailors. And then, of course, the chaplains. When they went after the chaplains, we covered that at great length. And those are just three areas, James, that I remember right offhand. But this stuff happened not by accident. And we're going to talk about who is responsible for that. In fact, James talks about, he names names in this book, about who actually proposed this and promoted it, and the personnel that were put in the Pentagon and in the military. And we're going to discuss that. This book is called Stand Down: How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. James is a former soldier. He's done so many interviews with professionals in the Pentagon and in the military beyond his own personal experience. And his call for America is to wake up. And the last part of it is he actually has a plan to turn this thing around. So we're going to get to all of that. So stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I I'm announcing today that we're ending the ban on transgender Americans in the United States military. Effective immediately, transgender Americans may serve openly, and they can no longer be discharged or otherwise separated from the military just for being transgender. Additionally, I have directed that the gender identity of an otherwise qualified individual will not bar them from military service or from any accession program. In taking these steps, we're eliminating policies that can result in transgender members being treated differently from their peers based solely upon their gender identity rather than upon their ability to serve. And we're confirming that going forward, we will apply the same general principles, standards, and procedures to transgender service members as we do to all service members.
That was Secretary of Defense under Barack Obama, Ash Carter. Oddly enough, they made that decision, I believe it was January of 2016, just before President Trump was going to take office. It's just amazing. Of course, that was like toward the end of Barack Obama's time, and it doesn't say much about what led up to that, and we're going to talk about it. James Hassan is our guest. His book is called Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. I guess we could, interestingly, you know, that, James, came on the heels of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Just talk about the progression of that, if you could. I know it's very complex, but how it did affect the American military when it finally ended up being full-blown acceptance of transgenders in the military.
Yeah, so I think the policy the transgender service member policy is often conflated with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and in a lot of ways they're very, very different, because Don't Ask, Don't Tell was based on, how people live their lives outside of off-duty, whereas the transgender policy allowed service members to serve according to standards to whichever gender they identified with versus those of their biological sex. And how that plays out is that, and you know, the Army or the military in general has very specific and rigorous physical readiness standards for males and females that are designed based on biological differences between men and women. So, for example, an 18-year-old male soldier with 21% body fat is considered a liability and is non-deployable. But an 18-year-old female soldier with 21% body fat is considered fit for duty. But under the Obama policy, that the left is trying to reimpose, and that you can be certain they will reimpose if another progressive administration takes the White House in 2020, you could have an 18-year-old soldier who's biologically male and has 21% body fat, but identifies as female and therefore would be fit for duty when that service member otherwise would not be. And when this change was taking place, the Obama administration, the Obama DOD specifically, held a briefing for the chaplains who were, senior chaplains across all the different branches. And it was held by the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, the gentleman named Anthony Curta. And after the briefing, a senior chaplain for the Navy, but who was serving in the office of the Commandant of the Marine Corps at the time, approached Curta and expressed concerns about the policy. And Curta just looked at him and said, look, there will be mixed genitalia in our bathrooms, in our birthing units, and in our showers, and it's good for America. And his chaplain said, wow, sir, do you really think that's going to make us better at war fighting? And Curta responded, well, that's just the way it is. And I think that exchange just encapsulates the difference in visions between those pushing these progressive changes and, the men and women in uniform.
James, let me just interject a question. My recall is that Anthony Curta was an Obama appointee into the Pentagon, but I don't remember what he was charged with.
Yeah, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Military Personnel Policy. So he handled a lot of the personnel policy decisions, like the transgender policy that the Obama administration put in place.
Was he a military person?
He is a retired naval officer, believe it or not. But, as you mentioned in the last segment, I interviewed scores of sources for this book, and a lot of them were two- and three-star generals and admirals who were in the room while these issues were being debated, and one of them described Curta as a swamp creature. And so I think that those changes were getting pushed from on high, and seems that he was very willing and or eager to embrace them. So Under Secretary of Defense Brad Carson, for example, who is serving at the very end of the Obama years, said that his goal was to make the Department of Defense, quote, the nation's most progressive employer. But of course, that's not the job of the military at all. It's not to be as woke as Apple or Google. It's simply to fight and win America's war. But once that policy was put in place, then, you know, compliance was demanded. So then you ended up having force-wide training on gender identity and, you know, the transgender policy across the whole force. So if you were one of the vignettes from the training that I published in my book, deals with the topic of, quote, male pregnancy. And it's, discusses how Army commanders should react if they have a soldier who is biologically female, identifies as male, and then gets pregnant. And then it's this, the theme of the vignette continually references, quote, his pregnancy. But even just the average everyday soldiers, everybody had to take some form of that training. And one of the other vignettes that I included was a training slide that instructed soldiers that if you are, you know, biologically female, or if you're female and you have a biological male who identifies as female and showers with you, basically the upshot is put up with it. And I initially published that because it was sent to me by a active duty Army female officer who was justifiably concerned about the answers that she was getting on that front. So it was not just a policy change, but also a cultural change in that way, just imposed from above.
All right. So but let me ask you, what to you and I might be obvious question, but I don't think it necessarily is because our culture has changed so much. So, James, what's the big deal? Can't the military just buck up and, you know, continue to fight and not worry about who they're showering with? They're kind of tough anyway. So how in the world does that cause a problem in their readiness?
Sure. I think there are two ways. So first is that those difference in physical standards that we spoke about in terms of there are physical readiness standards for males and females, and they're designed based on biological realities because the military is, above all, an institution that's concerned with physical reality. And when you allow somebody to serve according to the physical standards of whichever they identify with, then you're just divorcing any kind of physical realities from your readiness standards. And if a male, biological male, can serve according to standards set for biological females, for example, what about somebody who identifies as non-binary? There are 7 states now that list X or non-binary as an option on birth certificates. What standard do we use for that? So that's one. And then the second is that simply if you're, and one of the sources I interviewed for the book was a recently retired chief of medicine at a major military institution. And the way he put it is, well, you can't have an endocrinologist downrange. So if you're relying on hormone treatments or testosterone injections or whatever, then you almost necessarily cannot deploy. And then the question is, why are we enlisting soldiers or Marines or troops of any kind who can't go downrange? And is it fair to that individual who has to take their place? Of course not. So I think that what the big deal is that the policy as articulated by the Obama administration is just incompatible with warfare.
Well, and James, when you're out on the battlefield, as you were in Afghanistan, I know we see this in movies, but some of us have not experienced this, what they call unit cohesiveness. You guys become like brothers, and how does that affect that part of your life, military life?
Well, yeah, I mean, that infantry units especially, combat arms units are very, very close. And you rely on each other. And at the end of the day, that the thing that people care about most, you know, as opposed to your race or your sex or your, you know, politics or religion, is just whether or not you can get the job done. And you know, while we're on that topic of those infantry units or combat arms units, that was another major policy change that the Obama DOD pushed down on the military. So they announced that they were going to create gender-neutral infantry units. And the debate was framed as women in combat. But that's kind of an Orwellian triumph, a triumph of Orwellian phrasing, because nobody was debating whether or not women were, you know, female soldiers were constitutionally capable of, being in combat. You have female Apache pilots, for example, would kill jihadis with 30-millimeter guns linked to their helmets. But the question really was whether or not it made sense to create mixed-sex infantry units, which have to walk up to 12 miles a day and carry 100 pounds of equipment while doing so. So when the Obama DOD pushed for that policy change, the Marine Corps said, hey, just give us a year. And we'll study this. And if the data says that this is okay, then we'll do it. But if the data comes back that this is going to make us less effective in combat, then we shouldn't do it. And they measured the performances of all-male squads versus mixed-gender squads for an entire year out at 29 Palms, California, at their training center. And what they found is that the all-male squads performed better up to 70% of the time. And to give one small example of what that looks like in practice, they found that, for example, the time that it took to evacuate an incapacitated Marine from a vehicle was 159% longer for the mixed gender squad. Mm. And if that vehicle is on fire, then seconds can mean the difference between life and death. Mm. So extra minutes are deadly.
But we also think
when the Marines... Go ahead.
Sorry. No, finish your thought, please.
No, I was just going to say, but when the Marines presented that data, that study, to the Obama DOD, Obama's Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, refused to even read the study in its entirety. So they just weren't interested. And what they did is they overruled the Marine Corps, and they used the success of the first two female graduates from Army Ranger School as the reason for doing so. And that story is a scandal all on its own, and we can get to that in a minute, but sorry to cut you off there.
No, actually, let's pivot to that in just the few minutes we have left in this segment, because I don't know this story. The only thing I do know is that women have 30% less upper body strength than men do, and I can attest to that, you know? So when we see these training videos, I find it hard to believe that even two women graduated from Rangers training school. So what is the story here that you tell in your book?
Sure. So, like I said, the success of those first graduates was the justification that the Obama DOD gave for creating mixed-sex infantry units. And they were upfront about that from the beginning. They said, this is going to be the make-or-break class that decides how we're going to do this. So after the first two female graduates completed the course, a number of whistleblowers came forward and told Congressman Steve Russell from the House Armed Services Committee that they had been under massive pressure to pass those graduates and that the standards of the course hadn't been upheld. Mm-hmm. So Russell, who was a graduate of Army Ranger School himself, asked the Obama DOD for the training records from the course. And Obama's Secretary of the Army at the time, John McHugh, just stonewalled Russell for months and refused mm-hmm. to even meet with him. And then finally told him that the records that he was requesting had been shredded. I was able to obtain some of those records from Ranger School sources, and I published them in my book, and they show that those whistleblowers were absolutely telling the truth. But the Obama administration was willing to undermine the integrity of one of the military's premier courses simply because it furthered their preferred social agenda or their preferred outcome.
James, let me just add something you know, of course. It isn't just that women... are not able in physical. That's why we don't have women NFL players. Do I need to repeat that again? There are reasons women can't do certain things physically. There are a lot of things we can do. We're just different. And
absolutely.
But the point is that it hurts the men too. I'll embarrass my husband for a second. I've heard him talk about when the FBI started using women agents, which they do, of course, women agents are everywhere, and they do some things very well. But when they got into their physical training, they would be paired with female agents. And then that meant the guys had to go easier. So what happened was the guys who are trying to train to do all this stuff did not get the proper training because they're trying to contend with their little female partners who were smaller and not as strong. And so they weren't as well trained either. And I'm sure the same thing applies when you do military training. My guest is James Hassan, and you can answer that on the other side of the break. James got it wrong. He's a former captain in the U.S. Army and also graduated of U.S. Army Ranger School. His new book is Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. One of the things that James points out is that it hasn't really changed in the halfway through the, at least almost to the end of President Trump's administration. We have not seen a lot of changes, and the problem still exists. So we're going to talk about maybe some of the other problems we're seeing, but also how can we fix this? Is it possible? James writes about that, and I'll ask him about it on the other side of the break. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
We're here today to discuss what we are releasing, which is the annual report on sexual assault in the military. Very concerning data this year. Where we are now seeing the biggest issue is being able to really get not only from the top down, which is what we typically have been doing over the last 10 years, but starting from the bottom up too, and recognizing that we need to have military members at all levels, and the academies too, cadets and midshipmen at all levels, taking responsibility for this. And what I mean by that is often when we talk to individuals in our focus groups, they say, well, I'm not a perpetrator and I've never been a victim, so I don't really think much about this. We need them to think more about it, and we need them to think about what are the experiences of those in their unit when they're joking around, making jokes that may be perfectly acceptable in the civilian world. It's not acceptable in the military, and it creates a culture and climate that is very much counter to good order and discipline. It's counter to our expectations to treat everybody with dignity and respect.
All right, so that's kind of key right there to what we're talking about, treating everyone with dignity and respect as though individuals had rights in the military. And I remember, James Hassan, when I was younger, many, many years ago, we used to have this plaque on our wall, and it was a kind of a famous Army poster. It said, ours is not to reason why, ours is just to do or die. You remember that?
Yeah, Charge the Light Brigade.
Yeah, okay, oh, thank you very much. I didn't know that part. But the thing of it is, when you enter the military, people don't realize, because so few people serve, that you really do lose your personal identity by necessity. Explain that. Why is that important?
Yeah,
how does that help?
We had this phrase in the Army that we would use all the time, which was, don't be an individual. That's what we would tell soldiers who were kind of on their own page and not acting for the good of the unit, but doing whatever they thought was best for themselves. And the traditional military ethos is that, you know, you conform to the military and you do what is best for the unit and for those around you, versus, you know, vice versa. But the progressive agenda, in a lot of ways, that's been imposed on the military has flipped that traditional ethos on its head. And instead, it focuses on the individual's identity and you know, how the individual feels or, you know, any number of different things. And that's simply just not compatible with a robust military culture that's focused on winning wars. And so you mentioned the academies, and that's a topic that I devote a chapter to in my book, because as one of the many people that I interviewed said, you know, if you look at West Point now, that's how the Army is going to be in 5 to 10 years. And I'm not a graduate of the academies myself, but I interviewed a whole host of academy grads and tried to channel their insights. So one of the things that we mentioned in the first segment were those safe space placards at the Naval Academy. But I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the changes at West Point or the Air Force Academy also. So at West Point, for example, their is now a diversity and inclusion studies minor that cadets can take, and it's chaired by three civilian professors. And these civilian academics are very open about the fact that they want that diversity and inclusion studies program to mimic the diversity and inclusion studies programs at, you know, Ivy League schools. But to put a finer point on that, one of the co-chairs of that program was a professor who surveyed cadets, conducted focus groups of West Point cadets about the Obama administration's transgender policy at the very end of Obama's second term. And when most of the cadets, and notably a lot of female cadets, raised concerns about things like privacy and open bay showers, or just the problems implicated by trying to evaluate biological males according to standards designed for biological females, this professor concluded, quote, more education is needed for cisgender cadets so that they could become more, quote, gender cosmopolitan.
Oh boy.
And of course, you know, the question is never asked, how does being gender cosmopolitan help our military fight and win wars? Well, obviously it doesn't. And if you asked the average American whether they wanted a military that is focused solely on defending us and might be a little rougher around the edges, or one that's very sensitive to pronoun use, I think that they would clearly choose the former, you know, because it, frankly, the Taliban doesn't care what your pronoun is. that's West Point. But there are issues at the Air Force Academy as well. Another anecdote that I mentioned in the book is one in which Academy leadership apologized for microaggressions committed against cadets, by a non-commissioned officer who was just simply addressing proper grooming standards. So those changes are playing out across the academies, and that's a huge issue because those are the future leaders of our military.
You know, my intersection with Air Force Academy is we have a Restore Military Religious Freedom Coalition to counter Mikey mm-hmm. Weinstein's dreadful
oh, yeah.
attempts to strip anything Christian from the military, which he's been very successful. So we had a lot of battles with him, and I think we had some victories. But he is, to my mind, the person that poisoned first the Air Force Academy and made it so hostile to any expressions of Christian faith. Where are we with that? Do you know? I don't even know if you get into that in your book.
I touched on it briefly. And it's gotten somewhat better during the Trump era, but again, not fully resolved. And a lot of that is because of the cultural changes and the push that was put in place during the Obama years. Some of that still persists. For example, one of the religious freedom issues at the Air Force Academy, if I recall correctly, was that a cadet was forced to erase a Bible verse that he had on his own personal whiteboard because Mikey Weinstein, like you mentioned, complained that simply by writing a Bible verse on his whiteboard, he was proselytizing the rest mm-hmm. of the cadets, and that was somehow a violation, which is absurd on its face. But that's definitely an issue that is present and hasn't gone away fully. It's all part of those same changes. The Air Force Academy hired a go ahead, sorry.
No, please, you go. Let's hear you.
I was just going to say, one last anecdote from the Air Force Academy was that they hired a visiting professor from the University of Mary Washington who taught a class basically on toxic masculinity, and that was his that's his specialty is toxic masculinity. And how teaching cadets that their masculinity is somehow toxic helps us fight and win wars, nobody's asked. But that's the pet cause of the left, and so it was pushed down on the military.
You know, that sounds kind of reflective of that clip we played when we came back with it. That was Elizabeth P. Van Winkle, executive director of the DOD Office on Resiliency, talking about all of these men. She wants them all to experience this training and all to be aware of all of these sexual abuses because they just need to all mm-hmm. feel kind of responsible. And that's part of the toxic masculinity narrative, I think. I'm curious, James. We know, common sense tells us, that so many of the people that were put in place during the Obama years are still there. Plus, I know that a lot of good men left, and you know that too. You're one of them.
Yeah.
So How in the world, I mean, did you expect, though, that when President Trump was elected that there would be a more of aggressive push to turn this around?
I did, yeah. And to quote a Marine officer that I interviewed for the book, he said, you know, if we can't turn this around when Donald Trump is president and James Mattis is Secretary of Defense back when he still was, you know, when are we going to be able to do it? And, I think in a lot of ways he's right. This is the time and the opportunity to push back on some of this. And the Trump administration did a good job with the transgender policy, but there's a lot more to be done. And in the final chapter of my book, I go through, you know, very specific policy changes that should be adapted. But overall, what it takes is, political courage. And what it really requires is viewing military readiness as a moral issue. Because that, at the end of the day, is what it is. We talk about military readiness as in the abstract, but all that really means is how well we prepared men and women in uniform that we're sending overseas on our behalf to confront the dangers that we're sending them to confront. And we have a moral duty to only adopt policies that are going to help them succeed and to reject those that don't. So to get into a few of the specifics, one thing that needs to happen is that there needs to be an analog to the VA Accountability Act brought to the Pentagon. And the VA Accountability Act was something the Trump administration pushed through, which allowed them to fire bureaucrats who were failing our veterans at the VA. But there needs to be a similar law that applies to the Pentagon. And as a three-star admiral I spoke to told me, he had a Pentagon bureaucrat tell him no to his face. Just no, I'm not going to do what you asked me to do because I'll still be here in 2 years and you won't. And
that's true. I mean, that's the way D.C. works. I know.
Exactly, right? It's a swamp. But if there's one institution that should be exempt from that, it's absolutely the military. So that's one. And then another thing would be to remove the percentage of civilian instructors at the academy. Because now it's 25% civilian academics at West Point. And two decades ago, it was 2%. And that has a huge impact on both the culture of the academies and also what's being taught there. And so you allow, by bringing in civilian academics from, progressive universities, you allow all of this craziness, frankly, from the left-wing worldview to just slowly seep into the military and change its culture and change what's happening. So I think that's another reform that's needed and is long overdue.
James, this book is a powerful tool to make a difference. So my question is, I don't know when it's been out, 2 weeks maybe? Or I may have that wrong.
It's been out about 2.5 weeks, yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm thinking, and I'm sure you're thinking also, that you need to be heard by officials in the Trump administration. Has that begun?
I would love that. Say again, I missed that last part.
I just ask you if that had begun yet.
Without getting into too many specifics, some extent, yeah. We actually had a really positive reaction, which has been very, very encouraging. I'd love to sell books, but that's not why I wrote the book. I wanted to make a difference. And it's been heartening that there have been some good overtures from some folks who are in a position to make a difference, which is great.
How about media appearances? Because I'm guessing that you're not getting many invitations from network news or PBS or
the CNN or MS. No, not from those networks. No, I was on Tucker and also was on Ben Shapiro's show and a number of different other radio shows, and we're looking to possibly get on a few more national TV programs. In the next day or two, actually. So, say a prayer that we do and that we can continue to spread the message because it's one that's really important.
James, if you have said you have a lot of family and friends still in the military, I'd be curious to know if people inside the military have gotten numbed to this, used to business as usual, or if they view your book or the things that you're saying as something they're resonating with and praying that you can accomplish.
I think the latter. So one of the most encouraging responses to the book in the first few weeks that it's been out It was just the number of emails and messages that I've gotten from people who aren't just veterans, but who are still on active duty. And, you know, saying, you know, basically things like, you know, this needs to happen and, you know, please continue to push. And so if nothing else, just letting those men and women know that their voices are being heard makes it all worth it. Because at the end of the day, they don't have a say in this process. The men and women in uniform can't speak publicly about politics, and they have no lobbying power on the Hill. And, usually they don't have a whole lot of money to give to politicians. So they're relying on us to have these conversations because they can't do it publicly. And that was something that was always very frustrating for me when I was still on active duty. Because, you see these things and you think, I want the American people to know. But you know...
Yes, I do know that. We cover some of the bases, and I remember when I used to get a lot of phone calls, and after that shooting, like at Fort Hood, they just shut down all the public discourse from soldiers about what happened there. I'll never forget that. They were completely silenced in a new and more rigorous way. All right, this book is a great tool. Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. We need to support James and his efforts. All of you military folk out there want to order this and pass the word on it. See if we can't get something done. James Hassan, thank you so much, James. Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.